Good morning. That ought to be loud enough. And welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. My name is Michael Oldfather. The order of service identifies me as today's convener. The order of service, or that esteemed office, is vested in someone who will organize the day's program, help to select the music, and see to it that we begin and conclude formal activities on time. Pretty close for the start here. The convener's manual reminds conveners to encourage those in the audience who speak during joys and concerns or the discussion period to wait for the traveling mic, to keep it about 2 inches from your lips and parallel to the floor. That's how it works best. That will enable those wearing headsets and those who might benefit from doing so to hear from what you say. In addition, using the mic will allow anyone who listens to a recording of the program to hear what it is you have to say. If you are new to the congregation, the more information about us is available in the back of the bulletin, online at UUFM.net, from almost anyone wearing a name tag, and in the monthly newsletter, copies of which are available in the narthex, the room back there. All are invited to remain for coffee, tea, light refreshments, and conversation after the service. I've been encouraged to try something new, namely, not to let the speaker be trapped in this corner from which there is no escape. Instead to allow me to escort him out there someplace where he today can get a cup of coffee and have a chance to participate out there. But we'll see how that goes. Each morning, the formal part of our service begins with lighting the chalice, today's theme is helping others, I read this piece by Dorothy Day, Commitment. People say, what is the sense of our small effort? They cannot see that we must lay one brick at a time. A pebble cast into a pond causes ripples that spread in all directions. Each one of our thoughts, words, and deeds is like that. No one has a right to sit down and feel hopeless. There's too much work to do. The opening hymn is number 83. I don't ever remember singing it here. I chose it partly, I like the sentiment there, but also because it was written by Charles Wesley's grandson, one of the few things we have in our hymnal that helps to make a Methodist feel a little bit more at home. we'll ask Renee to play it through and stand as we get toward the end.
We'll be right back.
I don't know where the children are, but if they and maybe a microphone will find its way to me up here in the front. Well, as I said earlier, this program is about helping others, and I know you're going to take a trip to the imaginary beach this morning, and I suppose there you might have the opportunity to either, if somebody is building a sandcastle, what might you do to help? Huh? What would you do to help somebody?
Get them more sand.
Get some more sand. How about knocking it over? No, that wouldn't help much. All right. Suppose you're coming into the building and somebody ahead of you is on crutches. What would be a good thing for you to do?
Wait for them to go.
All right. That'd be part of it. Anything else you can think of to do? Oh, big kid over here. Anything else you might do? On crutches? Both hands busy doing something?
Open the door.
There you go. All right. You have lots of opportunities to do that. You know, some of the people you help are strangers, but some of them are people you're related to. You ever have any opportunities to help any of your relatives? Brothers? Sisters, mothers, fathers, grandparents, any of those things to help them? Okay.
Help them make dinner.
Set the table, things like that. Well, there are all kinds of ways to help people. And another important thing sometimes is to let people help you. That's a nice thing to do. Well, we're going to cut this short and send you off to the beach envy you there, but so. This is the second Sunday of the month, and so, as is always our custom here, some good cause is designated as the recipient of the collection. So as the collection plate makes its rounds here, if you don't... You know, that's right there in front of me. Let's do that first. I think that's a good idea. It's even in capital letters. All right. This is the time before we take the collection to allow people who would like to do so to speak up about things in their lives that are of importance, joys, concerns, things of that kind. Oh, there's one.
Mark Moser, and I did have something I had to say, so sorry.
That's all right.
After a really long, difficult time in the hospital, my dad's passed away. Oh. So I wanted to say I'll miss him very much.
Larry Weaver, my wife and I celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary last week and enjoyed it very much.
All right.
That was a real joy.
Hi, my name is Sonia Birdwell. And last few days, I just noticed that I just finally just went full circle in my life. And I'm experience of happiness. I'm finally moved on to a new chapter in my life, and I'm enjoying every bit of it.
For these joys, passages in life, concerns, we are with you who said nothing, and we know that there are some unspoken joys and concerns that we are want to be supportive of as well. Now, back to where we were. Each year we ask for people to or agencies to submit a proposal to be considered for the Helping Hands Sunday, and then evaluate those entries. And this year for the, I think it's the second, maybe the third, second or third year, one of them is the Flint Hills Community Clinic. And Susan Reed will tell us a bit about that organization.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to thank you guys for having us here today. How many of you are familiar with the clinic and know where we are and what we do? A few of you, okay. We are a primary care clinic here in Manhattan, and we serve the uninsured Riley County residents. No insurance coverage whatsoever, so TRICARE, Medicare, Medicaid, anything like that. If you have those things, we don't cover you. We try to make it so that anything that a patient comes into the clinic for is of no charge to them. We try to take away as many financial burdens as we can so that we can have people come in and take care of whatever chronic problems they may have so that we can start working on preventative problems as well. When we do grants or we have people who give to us, some of the things that we use those funds for, we find sources where we can get medications. If you know anyone who has diabetes, the diabetic medications and assistive devices and things are so incredibly expensive. We have sources where we can either get those free or greatly reduced to our patients. We have a patient assistance program with the pharmaceutical companies as well for medications, but we can't cover everything. So some of the medications, when someone comes in and is diagnosed with something, we try to have, the most favorite medications of the doctors, antibiotics, blood pressure medications, heart medications in stock so that we can get people started right away and there's no gap because there's no funds for the family. So we also appreciate the volunteers that we have. We have a very large volunteer base. Right now we have, between our providers, data entry people, we have about 120 volunteers that assist the clinic. So we appreciate our volunteers, and if you know of anybody who wants to volunteer, we have them come down. We will take them. There are, 14 local physicians, three nurse practitioners, and probably two specialty docs right now that come into the clinic and see patients. We also have about 65 specialty doctors that work outside of the clinic in their own offices that see our patients. There might be some charge for the patients when they go to the specialty docs, but for when they come in to see us, there is not. We do have a pediatrician now. We also have a dermatologist that comes in quite often. So we're getting a really well-rounded provider base down there. So that is kind of what we do. Do you have any questions on what we do or who we serve? Yes, sir. Yes?
Why are your clients not getting coverage through Obamacare?
I get asked that question a lot. I have an example of one of our clients who has some pretty serious heart issues. If he was to go onto that system, his medications would go from being free with us, and he has quite a few, to being $19 per generic and $50 per regular prescription. It also goes from him having no cost to see us to him having that monthly payment of about $118 a month. So at the end of the year, it kind of rounds out that he may get something back on his taxes to where it's free or very reduced, but you still have that monthly payment that you have to make, like an insurance payment.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Some of that is because also Kansas has not expanded Medicaid, so we still have that gap of people who aren't covered. If Kansas should decide to expand Medicaid, then you know the need for clinics like ours would reduce quite a bit.
Thank you, Susan.
Welcome.
Thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
Great, great program.
The offertory is by David Lance, Return to the Heart. Our speaker this morning, Reverend Patrick McLaughlin, is associate pastor at First United Methodist Church. Patrick is a phenomenon somewhat akin to Cher or Madonna, a person identified without reference to a surname, as in, Patrick has been working on this. Patrick knows all about the barriers to interagency cooperation on this issue. My first contact with Patrick occurred about 2 years ago at an early meeting of representatives from several churches concerned about issues involving local undocumented immigrants. He has been a tireless worker for that group, Voice for Justice, and for many others in this community. A few days ago, I was discussing the Guardian Angels program with the president of a local bank. He told me that some Patrick was scheduled to speak at the organization's next meeting. I told him that Patrick was dating one of the bank's employees. Well, I've met him, so that's Patrick. Well, soon it will be your turn to be able to say, why, I know Patrick. He spoke at our church Sunday. Patrick McLaughlin.
Well, I very much appreciate the invitation. I'm honored to be here among you in your fellowship this morning. Thank you for inviting Megan as well to be here with us. She works at a bank, and if a preacher can date a banker, then you know that there must be some room for collaboration among theists and non-theists and all the above, the whole mix. Well, I am Pastor Patrick. It's been an honor to be in this community for the last couple years. I've started my third year now. July 1st, the Methodist system has a way of moving their pastors about to try to match gifts and graces. And so far, this has been a good fit, and many of us pray that it will continue to be a good fit for a while we continue some of these initiatives that I've been invited to talk about. What you have listed there is a sermon, and I'm not sure it's quite going to be a sermon this morning, but maybe akin to a sermon, I can offer you a witness to what I've experienced in the last 2 years, and a witness to what I hope is on the way. I'm unapologetically a theist. I know that that doesn't apply to everybody in the room, but I also believe that there is a way of talking about a goodness in the world, a common commonality between us that unites us all, whether you see that being through a God or through another way of talking about that goodness. I think that we can find ways to relate. So thank you again for the opportunity to come and be with you this morning, and we'll start in with what we've got here. If you wouldn't mind, we've got the cover on the... it would like a power. FUMCMAN. I'll do my best to speak more clearly into the speaker here for those. Is it okay if I adjust up a little bit for my height? There we go. So new initiatives in Manhattan is what I've been invited to speak on. But I'll go to the next slide and just give a little bit of a background. There's a lot of text here, but just who is this guy that you've invited to come speak? I'm a Hutchinson native, just down the road, went to Washburn, got a biology degree, which helps inform my understanding of the world considerably. I did go to Emory University's Candler School of Theology, a point that I'm very proud of. They gave me a scholarship to go there, and I was very intrigued by the opportunity to go and study at a top 25 research institute where I worked side by side with many law, medical, public health students to learn how to study together. I recognized early on that these are the kind of people that will be in my congregations, so it's important for me to be able to speak their language and communicate with them. I always have to go back then to the first point there, though, because I'm not just an Atlanta big city guy coming into our small town trying to change our ways. I really am from Kansas and have a lot of strong Kansas values and a strong investment in seeing Kansas be a place where people can live and be happy and prosper. So I am that hometown kid still. I did arrive at the church downtown just over 2 years ago. They were eager to have a pastor with more community involvement. I'm not sure that they knew what they were bargaining for. They might have envisioned something different, but so far they've been fairly happy with what they've received, and I'm happy for the opportunity to be there. I am a part of a pastoral team, which largely allows me to do what I get to do. Our senior pastor primarily does the administration of the church and does most of the preaching. He had some choice in putting his associate pastor team together. Again, I'm not sure if he knew what he was getting either, but seems to like what he's got. Our other associate pastor, Melanie Martin, you may encounter her more often at the hospital or at a care home, as she attends to most of our congregational care needs. And then that leaves me as the associate pastor of adult education and missions. The adult education is kind of a new area for me, but missions is not a foreign one. That's how I found my entry into ministry. I grew up in the Methodist Church and didn't feel a real strong need for the church. I didn't understand. I was really bored with church until I found missions. Went off to Tennessee and did some outreach there, and ended up serving several summers in high school, every summer through college, and then worked full-time for a camp called Mountaintop. And it was there that I realized that the church had a purpose in the world, that we were here to serve one another, and we were here to help others experience what I would say the kingdom of God on earth. That offered a doorway into recognizing the differences between justice and mercy, something I studied a lot about while in seminary. And there's a story that kind of relates the relationship between justice and mercy that perhaps you've heard. These may be somewhat startling images to you, but let me explain. This is a parable of sorts. So take this man on the left-hand side, presumably pulling this child out of the water. He doesn't know where this child came from, but knows this child doesn't belong in the water, and pulls her out, goes up to the shore, finds some friends to help, and all of a sudden they find another child in the water, and another child in the water. And they repeat this process of pulling the child out of the water and then going to get help and coming back, and there's another child. These are acts of mercy, acts of charity. This child doesn't belong in the water, needs some immediate assistance. When we start talking about justice, we start asking questions like, why are there children in the water? What is going on here that is creating this scene where we have all these children? Must we stop our activity for a moment, or at least find somebody else with different gifts that can go upstream and find that somebody's throwing these babies into the water? What can we do about stopping the problem instead of just offering short-term charitable solutions? This balance between justice and mercy is really what defines the ministry that I feel like I'm called to help people in temporary needs of assistance, but then also to ask some larger questions about the systems that we've created to help them in order to better serve those needs, to have perhaps shorten the line, if you will, at places like the community clinic or the breadbasket, giving people agency in their own decisions and how they are able to survive and thrive in the world instead of remaining dependent on just being pulled out of the water. So what I've experienced in the first few years here is several chronically homeless folks who the shelter has attempted to help. We have a wonderful shelter. Emily Wagner, the director over there, and I have a great working relationship in communication weekly on folks who have no longer found themselves qualified to stay in the shelter. They have a very good program that helps people who can find work to transition into a transitional housing and to move out of homelessness. Those who are suffering from lots of different things and don't fit into that program find themselves back on the street fairly frequently. It's not a lot of people, which is hopeful, but it is a few, and it's been a recurring weekly process. We have many in our community that are suffering with mental and physical disabilities that are surviving on Social Security disability income and SNAP, which is the new food stamp, if you're not familiar with that term, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And it's just not enough. The SSDI payments, the SNAP benefits, it's not enough for a person to thrive on, barely enough to survive on with the help of lots of agencies. So these agencies we could consider charity. The questions we're asking about, is this enough? If this isn't enough, what can we do to change that? Those are where we get into that justice realm. And then thirdly, we have a lot of transient folks that make their way through Manhattan. I always ask, what brought you here? How did you land here? And one of the wonderful things about our community is it's known for its hospitality, not just its charitable services, but it's a safe community to be in, particularly compared to places like Salina or Junction City, which are right on the interstate where there would be easier access to transportation to wherever they're headed. So we end up buying a lot of bus tickets, folks that need to get to one coast to the other. I literally had in one occasion, two different families, one that was headed to California and one that was headed to Pennsylvania. And we were able to work with the shelter and work with some other agencies to fund two bus tickets headed in completely opposite directions to get these folks to a place where they had family, where they had a support system that might be able to take care of them amidst whatever chaos they were encountering at that time that brought them here. On the other side, what I've experienced in the community is some investment to maintain the status quo in responding to some of our issues of hunger, housing, and healthcare needs. It's difficult to enter into that justice realm. We have to do a lot more self-reflection, self-evaluation of whether we are doing what we can do. And we get comfortable sometimes in offering the services that we offer, and it's difficult to transform systems that we're invested into. Secondly, a resistance to finding more information. We often, I think, and this is part of a human condition, I think, paralyzed by a fear of being able to respond. We get trapped in looking inwardly. We see the need, but because of our own feeling of inadequacy, we don't want to ask more questions because we're unsure of ourselves. We don't have the courage to step up and enter the unknown, essentially. It's one of the reasons I really like the metaphor of the light. It offers us a way. We can see when there's a light cast on things. And I think that one of the things that we're all called to, and something that I hope to model, is being a light in some of these unknown areas, having some courage to step into not knowing the answers, but being willing to ask the questions so that some better questions may be able to be asked. Because that's usually what we come up with instead of answers is better questions. And that's always my hope. It's not all, this is kind of the scarcity, the deficiency side, what's wrong, what's going on. One of the ways that I describe the ministry I do is to finding where good things are already happening. As a theist, finding where God is already working in the world and joining alongside that. And that's incredibly liberating. I don't have to make anything up. I get to find things that are happening that are good and try to help build capacity in those things. And so that's why the next slide is titled, not, you know, new initiatives that I'm responsible for or involved with, but where I'm trying to just help build capacity. And these are some logos of the places that have really seen some capacity growth over the last few years that I've been honored to be a part of. We'll break these down a little bit. The first two, there's some associations that I've become involved with. The Riley County Committee of Social Service Agencies, I know some are involved in that within this room. There's another one called the Manhattan Ministerial Association. Both groups have done some wonderful work in the past, helping initiate things like the free clinic, coming together and making statements for the folks that are in need, making a stand saying, we are social service workers together. We believe that this change needs to happen. I think that that's happened in the past, and as I've entered it, I think we've lost a little bit of that fire to do some of those things. It's nice to be able to get together over a lunch once a month and meet the other pastors in town and meet the other social workers, but sometimes I think that that's all we do, and I'm not sure that that's the most that we could be doing. So I'm encouraged to be able to chair the Ministerial Association this coming year. There's several young new pastors in town. I don't know if you know folks that go to other churches, but I've counted up to 8 new pastors in town that are under the age of 40 that I think are really going to come together and help guide the church as a whole, the church big C, in a new direction that'll change the trend in the large church C of decline. I think that there's a level of authenticity that comes with some of these younger pastors. No offense to older pastors. They've paved a way that it's a wonderful platform for us to continue building on. But I'm really excited about some of the young pastors we get to work with. I think that's a sign of goodness, of God working, bringing together people in our community. It's encouraging to be a part of that. What they also offer is an audience to propose new initiatives, to gain support. There's always a lot of energy, a lot of excitement when new things are proposed. Inspiring leadership among those folks is sometimes a challenge because we're all working very hard, working to the bone. It's hard to remove ourselves from the work we're doing to ask where are the babies coming from. We're very inundated with the work of pulling the babies out of the water. It's also a great place for collaborative initiatives to take root. It gives us a reason to get together and hear a speaker and perhaps ask questions. Now that we have this information, what are we going to do with it? It's one thing to know about a service that's out there, but can we as a committee, as an organization, do something with this information to support them, to support our community with this new knowledge? Two initiatives that I've really enjoyed being a part of. Building Better is one that you may or may not have heard of. It hasn't taken a lot of root yet. But out of Habitat, we've recognized that it's difficult to find property in Manhattan. Property is expensive, and to build a new house here requires a lot to build that house on, and it's virtually impossible to do. If you're interested in housing issues and in Habitat, if you have land that you can donate or give for a cheap price or an affordable price, that would be one of the biggest gifts you can give to the affordable housing issue in Manhattan. Because of that barrier that we're facing, Roxanne Janes and a couple other community partners and I have gotten together to develop this Building Better program, where we focus more on home repairs, finding folks that need improvements on their home. Maybe they've got some code violations that they need to get taken care of so that they're not fined and further behind on their financial burden. It's been a wonderful opportunity to get to know Roxanne. She's a ball of fire. If you've gotten to work with her, you'll really enjoy to meet her if you get the chance. The second logo here is Change the World. This is a title of a book that our church read a couple years before I even arrived, but it's turned into a program of community service. And twice a year, folks, it started within the church with 100 or so volunteers. And last spring's event, we had over 500 volunteers, not just from our church, but from all over the community. Places like Target and Home Depot even put together teams to come and participate in this initiative, in addition to donating items to help with home repairs, lawn work, painting, you name it. If there's a project out there, and if you know a family that has a need for these kind of things, the Change the World program is an opportunity to do that. Primary partners that we've had in that so far, the Faith E-Free Church has really stepped up and has been excited to bring that under their missions. We're talking to Habitat, of course. They've been a great referral source for some of these projects. Some of the struggles that we've encountered are that most of the people in need in our community are renters, and it's difficult to invest that kind of energy into a rental property. And it's recently, I mean, this is an ever-growing, ever-evolving thing. It has recently occurred to me that if our focus is on building houses and fixing houses up, then this barrier of finding actual homeowners is one that can be a challenge. But if it's relationships that we're seeking, then why are we limiting ourselves to homeowners, especially if those who are in need are primarily going to be renting? Are there ways that we can work around this barrier to find ways to work with the people who have the greatest needs, who are likely renting, and put more focus on incorporating them into the neighborhood, incorporating them into the community? So that's a growing edge that we have, is how can we work with renters in the community? And of course, this only offers short-term fixes. A paint job on a house will only last so long. The hope is that a relationship will form and that we can address some more of the long-term needs that the houses. Successes, like I said, we've had some of the big box stores participating. It's been wonderful to get some of that corporate support as well as the local church and agency support. CTW is the short for Change the World, and it's grown from less than 200 to over 500 participants in 2 years. One that I know a few in the crowd are familiar with is Manhattan Voices for Justice. I've put it up here, the Spanish version on the title, because it's an outreach to some of our migrant community. If you're in and around, you might have noticed that we have more of a Latino population than ever, and it continues to grow. We work closely, at the beginning at least, with the school district to try to assess what that need was. And they continue to affirm that we have more and more migrant workers in the community that need some kind of assistance. And your local Ann Cowan is still, we haven't established a chair for this committee, but if there was one, it would probably be Ann. And so she could probably answer a lot more questions about this at another time. But our primary emphasis is helping children who qualify for the deferred action on childhood arrivals. This is an issue that we can, I hope, navigate through political boundaries, because most people can see children as innocent victims of, whether you see this as a crime or not, that the children ought to be given an opportunity at least to stay and get an education. And this DACA form will offer them that opportunity. We've identified, part of our work was to identify lawyers, find lawyers that would help sit through and work this paperwork with them, because it is legal paperwork, and it costs $500 to apply, so we don't want to mess that up. Where we're really able to save in finding those lawyers that will do it largely for free or for a nominal fee that we can help fundraise for, is that they've, before we're having to pay an additional $500 lawyer fee, in addition to transportation costs to go to Kansas City or to go to Salina to find an immigration lawyer that would work with them. We've identified several that we can help with transportation that will come to us if we have some folks that really need it in a concentrated time. So it's been wonderful work to recognize that growing need in the community and to recognize in the midst of an immigration problem where policies don't seem to want to change, that we can do something. And that's largely what we're grasping for. What can we do? And this is one opportunity that we've had. Sorry, this dark side is hard to read, but that goes through some of the eligibility requirements. Again, Ann probably has these nearby that she could give a copy of this to you if you're interested in helping with the migrant issue. One of the premier things that has come out of asking some of these questions that I've been honored to be an instigator and a primary organizer for is an event called Everybody Counts. We just had the event last weekend, the second iteration of that event, and these are the results from the first event that happened in January. We haven't had time yet to take all the data from our August 2nd event for me to be able to share those with you. So you can see some of those numbers. The initial push on that was we read a newspaper article from the Manhattan Mercury saying there were 250 homeless children in our school district. I actually heard about this report secondhand. I had several church members call me or pull me aside and say, "What are we going to do about these homeless children?" And I'm going, "Since when did you start caring about homeless children? Like, yes, let's do something." That's not a fair assessment of my whole congregation. But it was encouraging that they had their eyes open, that they wanted to do something about it. And I didn't know about the newspaper article yet. Then I found out that there was an article, and I at least knew that they read the paper at that point, and that they wanted to respond in some way. So we got a hold of Stan Ward, who works with the school district. He's got a big, long title, but he kind of does everything. Largely has to do with grant writing and serving the underserved folks in the school district. And he affirms that the 250 report is probably a lowball number. There are many who aren't classifying themselves as homeless, and just kind of to be honest about it, there is a broad definition of homeless as the school district defines it. If you're couch homeless, they want to count that and to know about that, meaning that you're sharing a house with another family, which some families do choose and want to live in that. I can't deny that is a reality, but the 250 that are self-reporting didn't self-report themselves as homeless because they were content in the situation that they were in. They swallowed their pride and came forward and said that, "I will define myself as homeless. I will take on that stigma. I will take on all the baggage that comes with that so that I can receive the help that I need." So anytime that somebody says 250, that's an inflated number. Like that's at least a bare minimum number that we can stand on. If I was living with friends as a couch homeless person, I wouldn't want to step up and acknowledge that. That's a difficult thing to have to talk about when you have need. So I think we can stand firm at least on that number. And the reports that we get from school social workers, from Stan, are that those numbers are likely a lot higher than that, and that a response is definitely necessary. We timed this with the point in time count, which is a housing and urban development thing. They fund housing initiatives throughout the entire country, and they require communities who are receiving those funds to do a homeless count every year. And so January is the day, is the month that they do that count. And it lined up perfectly with this initiative we were trying to come together. It provided us with a date to set for the First Everybody Counts event, which was, again, largely a success. With the count, you can see some of the numbers here of folks that were actually homeless in our community. What's encouraging about this is that that's not a huge number of people, which means that we can do something about this. It's not Atlanta, where I worked, and outside of my church on a Sunday morning, there were 100 black men lined up for lunch that were homeless. Like, this is a tangible, solvable problem that if we put our heads together and work together on, we could probably do something significant about that. We also asked some questions on the survey about why people came, what were their greatest needs, and there was the three that are listed there kind of in the bottom middle of the page: food, dental, and health care were people's biggest concerns. Some big questions came out of that. We have the breadbasket. We have mobile food distributions. We have church pantries. We have community meals. How is it that food is the biggest concern? And we think that helps us ask some better questions about access to these places, about is there a way to get to and from the breadbasket? Is there a way to get to and from the church meals? You have to have a car to go through a mobile distribution or not. It's out at Seco Park. Do you live downtown? So transportation is a big issue that we've raised as a secondary concern, not a secondary concern, but more of a root cause of why people are more concerned about food. Qualifications for those programs. The mobile food distributions, all you have to do is self-declare as being hungry, and you get a lot of food. Places like the bread basket, they have criteria which you have to meet in order to receive those services. They'll serve a family that comes in, no questions asked. Well, they'll ask some questions, but the first time they come in, you're guaranteed to get some food. If you start coming back and need that service recurring, it gets harder and harder to maintain that because you have to continue to prove that you're looking for a job. You have to continue to prove that you're a resident. You have to meet criteria in order to receive this food, which is a challenge for people. It sometimes is undignifying to have to prove over and over again that I am worthy of this free food. So some questions get asked, and they're questions that people that run agencies, we struggle to ask those because we have a lot of pride in what we're doing already, and we want to maintain a positive image in the community that we're meeting this need. And I understand some of the pushback that we get from asking these questions. If somebody came to me and said, there's no place to be spiritually fed in Manhattan, I would take exception to that. I know a few places where you can come and get spiritually fed. Somebody says, there's no place, I can't get food, and if I was the primary food distributor, I would take offense to that at first. But we have to move beyond that to ask some better questions, like why is food such a big deal? Dental came out. The Konza Clinic is opening. They're doing more dental care here in town now, which is a wonderful success. I don't know that we had anything to do with that, but we're moving forward on that issue. And what a coincidence that Susan and I were here today the same day for the health care concerns. We asked one question about how Affordable Care Act fits into that, and she answered that. But there's always that need, and people aren't always... I've got health insurance, I've got a decent paying job, and I still don't want to go to the doctor. I can understand why health, like, it's a concern, but it's hard to address. It's hard to actually go visit the doctor, and it's somewhat has to do with that being paralyzed by fear of unknown. What if we find something we can't fix? So healthcare and access to healthcare, destigmatizing the need for going and receiving help from a free clinic, all very important things. As we try to address those needs. We made a special emphasis in the second Everybody Counts last weekend to really highlight the health assets that we have in our community. We had one space in the church dedicated solely to food, nutrition, and health care. And we had several primary care physicians that came on site that were willing to see people for whatever they had, whatever they were going to bring. We didn't know what they were going to come with, and fortunately they survived the day. We had a dental hygienist come over from Community Health Ministries and saw 19 folks, were able to refer them on to several local dentists that were able to do some continued care with them at no cost. So it's been fun to see that community come together. When we first developed it, we didn't know who was going to come. We invited every agency that we could think of. In our small group of organizers, we divided the list, who we knew, pick up some unknowns, some strangers, and invite them to come. And we ended up with over 40 agencies that were willing to participate. And that spoke to us about a want from that social service community to be together, to get to know one another. And that was good because we didn't know if any of the folks who needed these services were going to come either. It's a new initiative. We don't have good relationships with them holistically. So we cast the net wide and used the mobile distributions to invite people, used the community meals, used the agencies themselves to direct people to the event where they could do, in a sense, a one-stop shopping to find out what services were available to them. We didn't know if they were going to come. So it was a primary objective that if nobody comes, at least we'll be in one room together and we can get to know each other better so that when I need to make a referral, I know who I'm calling. I know what they offer. I know that where we're duplicating services, I know where there's gaps in services now because we're all together and we can have that conversation. Well, fortunately, it didn't turn out that nobody came. We had over 350 people show up that day and come through and received food, received information, education opportunities, and we're hopeful that they felt that they were being cared for in that moment, that we cared enough to organize something like this, that they could come and find out all the information that they might need. So a great success. The Harvesters, again, was a big draw for that. I think we gave away 8,000 pounds of food that day, which spoke again to why food might be one of our biggest issues. Harvesters does a mobile distribution three times a month in between St. George, Wamego, Seco Park, and Westview, and they're getting ready to start another one through the Salvation Army downtown. They had already done two mobile distributions in January, giving away over 10,000 pounds of food in those mobile distributions. I was a little nervous that we were bringing 8,000 more pounds of food that we've already had distributions. They might not need it. What are we going to do with this food? It all went away. After two already successful distributions in the month, giving away 20,000 pounds of food, we gave away another 8,000 pounds. People are hungry. People need ways to free up their food budgets to afford some of the other things that they are needing in their lives. This was the flyer for the most recent event then, for Everybody Counts, August 2nd. We really wanted to make it more of a community celebration this time. We felt a lot of success in the winter event. We had one particular reason we wanted to do a summer event. We didn't feel like the January 29th was the best day to count homeless people in our community. In the wintertime, families are more compassionate. People are more compassionate. Folks aren't out on the street as much. Because they have folks that they can go and depend on. But when the summertime comes around, for whatever reason, more people are out on the street. And we felt like that would be a better time to ask a question of where did you stay last night? Again, we haven't tallied those numbers, but we're eager to see some of those results and get what we think might be a more accurate portrayal of the status of homelessness in our community. It was also designed to be less of a, hey, oh, poor people, we want you to come. We have all these things for you. And more of a, let's get together and celebrate being in community. We have all these wonderful assets. We have wonderful neighborhoods. Can we just come together over a picnic lunch, sit down and talk and enjoy the fine summer day that we ended up having? And it turned into that. We had lots of games out in the street for children to play, and we had a significantly higher number of children. We did it on a Saturday instead of on a weekday. That allowed some families to be able to come out. It was summertime, of course, not during the school year. So a lot more children were there, and that added a sense of life to it that was fun. There were a lot. We had migrant coordinators there, and I saw them busy all day long visiting with people who speak Spanish, that we're gaining some traction in that community, that they're learning to trust us, that we're not here to try to report them. We're not going to call anybody and say, hey, we've got so-and-so here. They might not be documented. They're learning to trust that we're actually here and we want to help. We're offering them translators so that they can actually communicate effectively in their first language. So that was encouraging that a lot more of that community was able to show up. The community resource fair went well. The health stuff I talked about went well. The food distribution, again, we gave away 5,500 pounds of food this time. We did dinner again that night. Everything kind of died down middle of the afternoon, and then about 100 people showed back up for dinner that night, which we were happy to serve. Nobody stayed in the overnight cooling shelter this time. It was a relatively mild day for August 2nd, I guess. But one of my observations on that is that if I lived in a tent down by the river, which I know several people do, I'm not going to pack up my campsite to go stay one night in a church. I'm pretty comfortable where I'm at. But if we were able to offer some more long-term solutions to folks who are living outdoors for inclement weather, when it's hot or cold, it's dangerous to be out there. And so something that we're really trying to push forward on, is organizing local churches to house emergency shelters in those times of bad weather when it's dangerous to be outside. There's still a lot of organizing that needs to be done for that. How do we communicate to people? Which church is it going to be? Is this duplicating services? Who's going to staff it? Who's going to be there overnight with them? A month ago, the shelter was full, and they had five people that they couldn't house. And typically, I'll get a phone call saying, hey, can you help with a hotel room? What can you do? These happened one at a time. So the first call, sure, yep, send them down. We'll see what we can do to help out. The second call, man, this is two hotel rooms. This is starting to get a little more expensive. And then when the third call came in, decided I'm not going to afford us hotel rooms tonight. We're just going to stay the night at the church. So the other associate at First Presbyterian, Zach Morton, if you get a chance to meet him, he's a nice guy, asked him if he'd come stay the night with me at our church, and we set up cots, and we had a mother and a daughter. These were the ones that they were headed to Pennsylvania. We had a single man headed to California, and we had another young man who he was a transient person. He only had two nights to stay in the shelter because he wanted to head to Colorado eventually, but didn't really have a clear understanding of where he was headed or why. But because he was transient, he was only allowed two nights at the shelter. So he stayed, and then one of our chronically homeless folks came and stayed the night because we had it open for him. Made him breakfast the next day, was able to get a tire fixed for the mom and her daughter, able to get a bus ticket for the man headed to California, and the kid that's chronically homeless has since found work at a roofing company. I went and bought him a pair of shoes last week so that he could have safe shoes to wear while he's at work, and he's found somebody that's willing to take him in for $50 a week. It's not probably a long-term solution, but by showing up, by being available, hopefully this person, these folks are all finding better places and better ways of living in the world. That kind of got beyond what we're talking about here. Nobody stayed at the cooling shelter that night. We also have now twice, both events, ATA has offered free transportation throughout the day. When we initiated the conversation, we were just hoping to and from the event, if somebody was coming to Everybody Counts, would you offer us transportation for that? And they decided it would be easier if they just made that a free transportation day throughout the city. I don't know how that was utilized. I need to talk to Ann over at ATA to talk about that and see if it was useful for them, if it was used broadly among the community. There was a lot going on in the community that day, so I hope that people used it for lots of different things. The last thing that I'll talk about here is circles. Has anybody heard of circles? Have you heard some of the conversations going on about circles yet? Circles is a national program. CirclesUSA.org is their website. I'm sorry, I don't have that listed up there anywhere. But it's taken a lot of traction in Kansas. We have more chapters in Kansas than any other state, and we're continuing to grow and develop new chapters. The mission I've kind of put into bold terms here to try to help understand better what it does, but there's a sense, a strong push for engagement with communities, not charitable, just handing down fixes for things. They talk a lot about, we're not here to reduce poverty. We want to end poverty. That's their goal, is to end poverty. Economic stability, of course, is a primary push for that. And then support of peers and volunteers. That peer and volunteer thing is where the expense really comes. It cost us $15,000 to initiate a chapter, to buy into the program, which, $15,000, that's a little chunk of change. What I've learned about Manhattan is that fundraising can be easy if you've got a good program. The funding part of it has been easy. The human investment is the expensive part. Finding volunteers that are willing to step up and chair committees, to be allies, which I'll get to some definitions to. The expense, $15,000, is a drop in the bucket compared to the human expense that this program is going to bring to the community. And so I will ask directly if you would be willing to be involved, and can pass some more information along to you if you're curious. This is the third point here about developing leadership of people, moving out of solutions to addressing their poverty, and addressing community and program barriers. We've talked some about the barriers as we've gone through some of these other issues that community that comes together. We'll get to talk about that together. So what is a circle? It's named, the program is named based on the infrastructure that it puts into place. Supportive, intentional, reciprocal. The befriending part is really a key to it. We talk a lot about our services as being social services. What I find is that we have a lot of professional services. If you go to DCF, if you go to the breadbasket, if you go to even the church, I'm a professional. I went to a graduate school. I'm offering a professional service in a sense. It's not really a social service until I become a friend to this person, until I become somebody they can count on to call when they really have a need. If maybe that's in the middle of the night, maybe that's on a weekend, not from 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, which is when our social services are available to people. And what Circles offers is that social support, social service. There's a weekly meeting where all these people come together, and again, I'll get into more who the people are. We talk about future plans and dreams, community resources that are available, these allies with the weekly meetings, and this big view. These are all teams that get together to help come around a circle leader. And a circle leader is that person who's trying to come out of poverty. It's very intentional that they are the leader in this relationship. They're leading themselves. We're equipping them to lead the way out of this, and we're here to come around them and to offer what support they might need. There's a 12-week training program before they actually become a circle leader. A lot of it is based upon Ruby Payne's work, A Framework for Understanding Poverty. There's another book, What All Churches Should Know About Poverty. There's some limitations to the language that's used in Ruby Payne's work. There's some criticism out there about her approach, but the feedback that we've gotten from people that come through it is that it works. It's effective. The language may not be perfect, but no language ever is. After we've been through the program, we can go back and kind of critique how we can change and talk about it a little bit differently. But when we talk about people in different social classes having different values, having different ways of being and seeing the world and trying to adapt to that economic class that we want to be in, means that we have to be able to translate, and we have to be able to speak that language. We have to be able to behave in those ways. Where the criticism comes in is that somewhat diminishes the values that are in people living in poverty's class. Is that necessarily good or bad, the way they do things, or is it just different? I think that being able to have that conversation, the difference between good and bad or just different, is an important one. The circle leaders convene. They pick these allies, which I'll talk about, to come around them that they can call. And it's not intended to be a relationship where, hey, I need $50 to do this, but hey, where can I go? I want to enroll my kid in school, or my car broke down. Who do you know that I can go to? These are the non financial resources that people living in poverty endure every day. They don't have the social connections that people that aren't living in poverty have. And allies offer that gateway, that bridge into those social connections that they need. A circle ally is also trained. This helps us overcome some of that fear, some of the paralysis that comes from not being able to respond because I don't have the answers. Well, we give the allies a similar training where they understand better the language and all the things that go around, along with being in poverty. So we train the allies, and then they come alongside and help to bring circle leaders out of poverty. Again, more of this information is available that we can share with you. But we're eager to start this up in January. We had a fairly ambitious timeline when we first set out. We were hoping by September we'd be able to start the program. But there's some larger picture wheels that are having to turn that we're having to wait for. Myself and another person are going to Atlanta in September to be trained to come back then and train and teach the classes that are necessary to have the program go on. So we're looking towards January. We'll be looking for allies then. We're going to be in need of financial support. The financial burdens of this come for paying a staff person, one full-time and one part-time staff person. Right now it's completely volunteer driven. Most programs run for a few years completely volunteer driven. We think that we have the charitable resources in town to hire staff a little bit more quickly than that and really get the ball rolling. There's a guiding coalition here. These are the committees that we're looking for people to be on committees. You can kind of see a description of what each of those committees do. If those are things that you're interested in, we'd be happy to have you come and join a part of that. There's also, of course, an executive committee that is fairly well in place at this point, but will be a rotating thing. We'll need new blood just like everybody at some point. And that's it. That is what I've been up to. That's where I've been trying to build capacity. I appreciate your willingness to hear that and would love to entertain some questions. I know that being on time to lunch is something we had value, so I apologize for speaking for so long and not leaving as much time for questions. But
thank you. I'm Kathy Hedge.
Hi, Kathy.
I was able to be at the event on Saturday, and it was really exciting. I wanted to thank you very much for doing that. And I've just wondered if there is when the follow-up information might be available and how we might be able to access that.
Absolutely. I don't know if everybody's on Facebook, but we try to keep things up to date on Facebook. Our church website will broadcast it. And right now I've got a doodle poll out trying to figure out when the best time to have a meeting to sit down and talk. We'll have that meeting. We'll have data at that point, and then we'll likely publish something in the newspaper. We'll give them a report of what we learned and where we're headed. So keep an eye on the news. You know, you can call me anytime. I'd be glad to talk about it with anybody that wants to call. So watch for those areas. Hand here.
Ann Cowan.
There she is.
Ann. I just wanted to give credit to some of our members here that we started the Voice for Justice group when our Social Action Committee wanted to join in whatever was happening with the undocumented in town, and we discovered nothing was happening. And the research and the setting up of the original meetings were done by Drew Venom and Stacey Broman, and really appreciate that they got it all started.
Yes.
And presently, our official faithful representative from this group is Michael Oldfather, who has done a lot of work with our group and actually took a family up to Lincoln to visit a free lawyer recently and went beyond the call of duty from that long trip, which took all day. He also took the family to the zoo up there.
Thank you. I had one hand here and another one over here. Green shirt behind.
I just wanted to know how close your ties are to the school district. You mentioned Stan Ward, and he knows what's going on, but what is the practical involvement of your efforts, and what can we do as teachers in the district?
Totally. You know, I think that you guys as teachers are one of the first lines of defense, recognizing children that may have needs and referring them to the school social worker who then works closely with Stan, and then Stan and I are in regular communication. Right now, school supplies are in high demand at central enrollment. They ran out just like that. We gave away some at Everybody Counts. They ran away like that. I don't know. They said they had 150 bags at the Douglas Center this last week, and I'm sure they went away real quick. So trying to address some of those school supply needs are one of the things. As a teacher, keep doing what you're doing. Thank you. It's a gift to be able to work in a classroom with students. So thank you.
As a sergeant-at-arms here, one more quick question, and then we'll close the service, and we'll be around.
I'll be
out
around
there.
Out front.
Out there. Okay.
Hi, my name is Sonia Birdwell, and I remember you from the beginning of this year. I was going through a lot of trouble, and you probably know Janet Weddle. She's the one who told me to come to you for dinner because this is before I went to a batter's shelter, but I was going through a crisis, and when I came to your church and I ate, you know, it was really different. But by you doing that for me, even though I only went like twice, it mean the world to me. It helped my son. It helped me. And I want to say thank you. But I'm doing fine. And what you did, you showed me how to pass on God's love. And I want to say thank you for doing that. Now I'm not helping people, homeless people, but I'm helping women that are being hurt. And I'm trying to get them out of the predicament. Mm-hmm. But you have a big heart. And I want to say thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. You're welcome. I might say that those meals are available for anybody to come and to be in community with folks. We do ours on Wednesday night, but there's one almost every night of the week. That's one of the biggest needs is for folks that have to come and sit across the table from those who have not and try to help them feel a part of the community.
Closing hymn is Hail the Glorious Golden City, a familiar tune written by Felix Adler, who was the founder and president of Ethical Culture Society. All right. Stand and read. Slight paraphrase of John Donne's No Man is an Island. No one is an island entire of itself. Every person is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Anyone's death diminishes me because I am involved in humankind. Therefore, never send out to ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for all of us. Thank you. Well, nicely done.
Thank you.